Good day and well met, Brendan.
May the force be with you, Alan.
The Not a Thing podcast, episode 168. It's like nerd Christmas Eve today.
It kind of feels like it. There's something in the air, and it's not fucking in accordance.
So we're recording. I guess Star Wars has already premiered in the UK, I think.
LA.
And maybe even parts of the US that are special. I don't know. All I know is I'm not seeing it until I think Friday. You're seeing it Thursday night. Okay. Well, we'll more than likely talk about it enough. I don't want to give the Disney Lucas machine too much more airtime. They're certainly filling all of my other airtime. We would like to present to you a podcast mostly Star Wars free.
But not 100%. And I know that's, we need to keep it, you know, reasonable.
Right.
Because next week is going to be bananas for Star Wars.
It might be 100%
that could
of the show.
Be the whole episode.
It might be.
I'm totally fine with that.
Well, we'll get to that when we get there. In the meantime, let's see what is on the old internets today. We learned this morning. I actually learned it from a friend of mine, Scott, who I don't know if he listens to the podcast. If he does, we should have him on totally. But he tweets. And he had tweeted some things. He's a teacher in LA, and LA did something pretty much not unprecedented. I guess it's been over 20 years though since something like this has happened. The LA Unified School District closed, I think it was 1,200 schools, which range from like kindergarten all the way through high school, these are all public schools in the LA area. And it's over 600,000 students, and all of them were told to go home. They could not come into work there or come into school rather. They were turning them away at the schools because the a combination of folks, and I'm not sure who actually made the call about what was happening, but the short form is they got a number of terrorist threats saying that there were not one but multiple attempted bombings that were going to happen at public schools in LA, and it was enough of a scare that they decided to close the entire school district worth of schools until they could be swept. It turns out there was no actual bomb. It was a hoax. And furthermore, the New York school districts also got a similar message. And that was one of the clues that they thought maybe this wasn't credible. Apparently, whoever's in charge of schools at that level in New York even pointed out when the announcement was made about LA that they had received a threat, and at that point had already decided that it was not credible. So there's a lot of kind of issues swirling around this. I mean, I'm sure the law enforcement in Los Angeles County is probably still on edge after the stuff that happened in San Bernardino. And we're treating this as more of a kind of precautionary issue. I think that's good. I also think that it highlights a bunch of failures of communication, just because the because New York had similar threats. It turned out that they looked like they were the same threats, which highlighted more that it was a hoax and not some nefarious plot. I mean, it was nefarious in that it worked in LA anyway. It forced a bunch of agencies to spring into action. It inconvenienced hundreds of thousands of students and parents. It's a mess, and I think it absolutely sucks. that Crying Wolf works right now. But I think that's also due to so much interagency kind of trouble and the ability to kind of verify things and connect things and make those calls is a problem. It highlights that certainly, and it also highlights the culture of fear and how it's not out of the realm of possibility that someone would want to attack schools in LA, that it's that you know, just whatever mail they got was enough to call it a credible threat. So that 100% is not a thing, and totally sucks. I really am grateful that there was no actual bomb. I know Scott and my other friends who live in LA were probably relieved as well, but I think the relief is giving way to a lot of just frustration about how it was handled and how it was communicated. It just sucks. It's just not a thing.
Well, and I mean, this is something that New York's had to deal with previously, as we all know.
Yeah.
And so I think their attitude is probably different than here on the West Coast.
Hmm.
That's not been a thing. And I also saw that the LA Unified School District, if I think this is accurate, made the decision before they consulted the LAPD.
Huh.
Whereas I think in New York, there's probably a lot more communication between the NYPD and New York schools.
I guess so. I mean, I think a lot of it is them just being on edge, and rightfully so. But I think that it also shows from a kind of, if you look at the bigger picture, quote unquote war on terrorism, and how we've been spending a lot of energy fighting terrorists who are abroad. I think understanding that there is terrorism domestically, and not like actively militarily dealing with that domestically, but really trying to find out what the root of all of that is, and dealing with that rather than dealing with what I consider the symptoms of the problem. So I hope we and law enforcement agencies and other agencies can kind of wrap their heads around that and kind of work on it. I think kids just want to go to school, or rather they should go to school. Whether they want to or not, I think that's something else. Kids should stay in school. That's a thing.
Learn the children. The children are our future.
Well, kind of moving further into the future here, Philips, which they make a bunch of things, but most notably light bulbs. They had a light bulb platform that was kind of internet enabled. So theirs was, I think it was called Philips Hue. But they you would buy light bulbs and then pair them with a light bulb controlling bridge, and that would be internet enabled. So all of the bulbs could talk to each other and to an app, and you could control the lights and all that kind of stuff. And initially, because I think Philips was partnering with another group in order to make the bridge, the thing that actually talked to phones and computers. And because that was a third party, there was some flexibility in how the platform worked. So you didn't have to buy Philips light bulbs. There were a number of light bulbs that would also work with this bridge, or at least that was the hope. Philips released a firmware recently, which ended up locking the bridge down to only use Philips bulbs. So they've essentially rolled out light bulb DRM. And for those of you that are new to the podcast, the Not a Thing podcast, DRM is not a thing.
Nope.
We've talked about it at length for a number of reasons. The major reason is it prevents use, just like this. It turns what was an open and kind of competitive system that allowed you to use different bulbs from different manufacturers and use them kind of harmoniously in your house. Instead, they force competitiveness by breaking the cross-platform ability. So it would lock out other bulbs from working on the system. And they're citing that the other bulbs were not up to Philips's standards about working, but rather than work with the platform to make it compatible to the other bulbs, they just decided to lock out all the other bulbs. And this is the classic walled garden metaphor for how kind of ecosystems of products grow up. So rather than having kind of an open platform that other people can come into, kind of like having a marketplace which determines who wins and loses or who does well and who does not based on, you know, people's open decisions on being able to see how products perform, you know, against each other. Instead, they've erected a walled garden, which everything works within that garden, but you don't get to see the outside. You don't get to know if there's things that are better or not because you're locked into a particular system. And DRM is one of the major way to kind of do this. There are other ways you can kind of create that ecosystem. Apple doesn't necessarily lock out other things from working with it, but it does really highlight a lot of the integrations that only work with Apple. So I think that and there are other things that create that walled garden system. iCloud is definitely one of them on Apple's side, but I think it's really interesting because light bulbs and thermostats, actually, now that I think about it, as you start looking at things that are internet enabled, the things that come to mind, you know, that are household based anyway, are light bulbs, thermostats, and refrigerators. Apparently, refrigeration was one of the first things. I know LG made a refrigerator with a screen in it, and it could tell, you know, if you told it when you put the milk into the refrigerator, it would know how long that milk is good for and could signal you. I think the Internet of Things is coming along a little faster, but lights are one of those things that everyone generally needs. You want some light, otherwise you go to sleep when the sun goes down. And then having internet enabled lights is somewhat interesting. I actually do have a set of bulbs. They're from a different maker. I believe it's Lifix, LIFX is the brand, and I can, from an app, control the color and the brightness of the bulb and do that on a schedule. Or there's some neat things where you can tie it into other systems. So like if I get home, it knows based on my phone that I'm within, you know, distance of my home, so it would turn the lights on, so I can just walk in and all the lights would be on. The things like that. I think having kind of an open system, encourages that to develop, and that's really what it is. It's a developing system of things. I think by locking it down, you guarantee that the features are only going to be developed in their own little silos, in their own little walled gardens, and whether those compete with each other or not is a whole different thing. And it's light bulbs. You're just plugging lights into your into your sockets. I feel like it's one of those internet conveniences that has a lot of potential, but it also is just so basic and so really unnecessary at this point.
It's stupid. It's not even like this is a new thing that now that okay they want to keep it proprietary before you know releasing it open. It the other light bulbs worked and they changed the firmware so that it won't.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not a thing. It's a neener kind of thing to do.
Plus, Hugh is a stupid name, so your thing's gonna fail anyways.
Well, I think the utility of it is still a little bit a ways away. I think because it is a developing kind of system, I think inserting any kind of roadblocks to it will only hamper development and innovation. I think that's really where kind of the interesting thing comes out. I feel limiting the innovation so only they can do it is really, one, selfish, and two, really behind the times. I mean, there's so many other like I was saying, there are other bulbs that that could work with their system, and it would be interesting to see if this turns into if the DRM war escalates and we get different systems that are made, or if kind of a more open kind of standard develops from how that works. Open standards are generally a good thing. I think part of it is just that the technology is just so new, and what figuring out what to do with it should take precedence over trying to make as much money off it as possible. But all I do know is that the nice thing about the bulbs is that they all tend to be the LED bulbs, which are the newer technology bulbs, which I love much more than the compact flash bulbs or the compact fluorescent rather. I guess the regular incandescent bulbs, they're on their way out. I know there was there's a move away from them just because of how much more waste there is in creating them, and then you know the relatively short lifespan versus other technologies. But I really disliked when compact fluorescents were a thing. I know as soon as we could figure out what color temperature we wanted, because the thing about like white light with incandescent light, you pretty much buy a bulb and then it's white. That's fine. But there was something weird about how fluorescent lights work, because it's not a because of the way the spectrum or the spectra are run on those, that they come out a very particular color temperature. So some will look very blue, some will look very yellow. And this is really only a problem if you have fixtures with multiple bulbs in them and you don't put the same bulbs in all of the sockets.
That's like your tires. You should do them all.
Yeah.
Rotate your bulbs, everybody.
Right. All right. Or just go to LEDs and you can they'll come out exactly whatever color you want them to, because they're assuming you have the digital controller that talks to them all, they will at least look the same color of white, which is a lot nicer. Also, the LEDs just come up much faster. Like compact fluorescents, like regular fluorescent bulbs, have to kind of warm up a little bit, and that's not what you want. You want light when you turn the light switch on. That's the thing.
So demanding.
Yes, we're worrying about light. I think this officially counts as a first world problem. But if you're listening to the podcast, you're aware of these.
If you're listening to the podcast and you don't have light, your priorities are wrong. We appreciate it, but your priorities are wrong.
Right, right. If you would like to participate in the stuff that makes this show run, we're happy to have you. We usually can spare a little bit of time for a guest or two. It was really fun having guest hosts 2 weeks ago. I think we might have a guest or maybe even three next week. We'll see how it goes. Depends on how it works. But if you would like to be a guest on our show, tweet at us, Facebook us, email us via, you know, go to the website, notathingpodcast.com, and let us know how that's going. We don't have any infrastructure, so there's no way we can take your email address and turn it into put you on a list or anything like that. We just don't have the bandwidth to be nefarious with your emails. So feel free to just,
or the inclination.
Yeah, feel free to just email us and we'll make it happen. An insurance group recently announced a line of insurance products specifically for dealing with online harassment. I believe it's the Chubb Group, which I only hear sponsoring things on, you know, NPR and public TV. But they are an insurance group, and they have a plan which will it will insure you for up to £50,000. They're it's Chubb Group, it's pounds, of course. Sorry, really bad joke. But they're that translates into $75,000 American. So if we're so then that $75,000 can be used for whatever you deem appropriate for dealing with whatever level of harassment you're receiving. And so it can range from a few different actions, like paying you for needing to take time off work because you're feeling so anxious, or paying for reputation fixing services if you've had to, you know, blow up a social media account because it's being spammed or trolled in any way. I think some of the actions sound kind of better than others, and it'd be really interesting to know like what the how those remedies are chosen, and what the process is for kind of putting them together. I think troll insurance ideally should not be a thing. But I think it does bring to the forefront how much more mainstream it is that people are getting harassed online, and that, you know, insurance companies have decided that that's a product that they know there's a demand for. This reminds me of, I worked for a company a while ago. I think it still exists, so I'm not going to remember. I'm not going to name them, but they did insurance kind of portfolio analysis, and they would do things mostly for natural disasters and stuff like that. They would analyze, you know, an insurance company's portfolio of clients, and then say what their exposure was to, you know, this or that. And it's like, oh, you have a lot of clients who live in Florida, and that's very hurricane prone, so it's very likely you'll have to pay many of these. So these were like the number crunchers of the number crunchers that would do the calculations for insurance companies. So I was working for them in kind of early 2000s, and I remember them talking about it was the first inklings of setting up terrorism insurance, and talking about, you know, insuring things for that level of stuff. So I think it's it's interesting that there's going to be insurance for online harassment. I think it's something that will probably continue to evolve about how it's created. I think it's a major bummer that it exists, but only because it's a major bummer that trolls exist.
I also had a major bummer when you sent me this story. I really thought it was going to be about some sort of Norwegian insurance against trolls of the mythical variety.
You just have to stay away from bridges and it's no problem.
Or the woods.
I guess they're in the woods too. I only remember the story.
We're speaking of bridge trolls here in America.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the big Norwegian trolls. As seen in the documentary Troll Hunter.
Point taken. I think maybe there is a niche for that in Norway anyway. So we can look into that. I think that's more easily justified than the online troll variety. Although again, online trolling should not be a thing. Hopefully we figure out kind of better ways to mitigate the effect of them. In the meantime, having insurance to potentially deal with them is now a thing. So, I don't know. We like I was saying earlier, we don't have a lot of time or inclination to be nefarious to other people. Thankfully, not a lot of people have decided to troll the Not a Thing podcast, at least so far. So we'll be saving your podcast dollars by not investing in troll insurance.
if we're getting trolled to the point that we're going to need to spend money on it, I think the podcast is over.
If you would like to sponsor the Not a Thing podcast so we can buy troll insurance and cover other expenses that might exist, please let us know via the means previously discussed, hashtag flat earth. Kind of moving on from that one into some more kind of internet related things. There's some studies recently about people using the internet and specifically the emotional state in which they use the internet. I mean, maybe you are you're happy and you're using the internet. Maybe you're sad. Maybe you've just been trolled by someone and you're really angry. There's all sorts of emotion that comes along with living and being alive. So
hopefully,
what some researchers have looked into is that how your emotional state is reflected when you're using the internet, and specifically browsing websites, moving the mouse, using the keyboard, that kind of thing. And they did some studies via a number of means to kind of figure out if what happens kind of as a broad scale pattern if someone is anxious and using the internet, do they move the mouse more erratically? Is it more methodical? What happens? And I think it was an interesting set of sort of tests because they used I believe it's called Mechanical Turk, which was an Amazon thing, I think, where
yes,
you advertise yourself as a person that can do like really small tasks, and so they use that pool of people to do this research study. And what they had them do was you use a website, but then kind of rate themselves emotionally at the time and have a bunch of tasks to go through. And what they found was that they could predict kind of the emotional state of the user from a very gross, like, happy versus angry perspective. And they could predict that within, I think it was 80%. It was like 82% or something like that. And there was they listed a number of symptoms that were like if a person is angry, their mouse usage, the parameters were interesting. It was like you would move much wider distances for clicking on things. So maybe that meant you would overshoot the thing you were going for, but you would also move more slowly if you were angry versus if you're kind of in a normal state or a happy state. So I think the findings for it are interesting about what would constitute, you know, a symptom of someone being happy or angry or whatever emotion. But the implication in the article is that once a website or has that information, it could potentially modify the interface and what's presented in the content in order to bring you to an emotional state which is more conducive to whatever they want to probably sell you. I mean, let's be clear, it is the internet. But I found this indelibly creepy. Just the
let's find ways for computers to read our emotions more. That's what we want. Let them learn more about us.
Well, I think it also it connects back to a number of things which we have talked about in the past about like kind of fingerprinting you based on certain information. I'm sure. We talked about it a while ago about how like people have a particular walk, and so the way that your body mechanics move are really a fingerprint of you, and so they could potentially link up the data from your Fitbit to even though it's anonymized to kind of pick you out of a crowd of different Fitbit's data. And do other kinds of connections on that. I think this could be, paired with other things like, you know, to determine your emotional state and then translating, you know, aligning that with what websites you're going to and what you're doing and what you have done and what you're trying to do. And it just borders on like those feelings of like thought crime for me. Not a thing.
No.
It makes me want to mix up how I use my keyboard and mouse. I'm sure there actually I know there are, because I think we even talked about them on the show before, that there are apps that are there for fuzzing your keyboard and mouse usage, so it runs them through a randomizer. So when you move the mouse and click on something, it will register where you moved it to and where you click it to, but it kind of inserts a bunch of noise into that data file as it writes it to the mouse. So it would mix up those kinds of fingerprinting attempts to determine who's using a computer at any given time. It would mess up the rhythm of you typing and stuff like that. I'm not sure I'm paranoid enough to implement things like that. But
you're curious enough to do it.
Or would it just recognize me as like a paranoid person?
and then
it would act accordingly. It would modify itself accordingly about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's on to us.
They'll probably figure that out. But in the meantime, until it gets to the point where it will, pick my Facebook status based on how I log into Facebook. then it's gone too far. We'll keep an eye on it until then, though. So we're moving from stuff on computers to stuff in the skies, specifically stuff in the skies over Tokyo, Japan, where they have a lot of drones. I think it's not surprising, Japan being kind of fun futuristically every once in a while. They have a lot of interesting technology things that that tend to be kind of test-bedded there first. One of those things is drones, and they're already kind of a lot of drones in Japan. There's a operational kind of limit to them set by various laws that are already kind of enacted. And there are also no-fly zones for drones, and those are supposedly kind of marked, and kind of people are aware of them. I have not seen such regulations and things like that in the United States, although I'm sure it's coming soon. But in Japan, not only have they already encountered that, they're already dealing with it. Japan, I don't know the agency that's in charge of it, but whatever that agency is, they are pretty cool because they have
Metropolitan Police Department.
Oh, it's specifically Tokyo then.
They're drifting into the skies. Yes.
Yes. So they have a drone squad, and I don't mean like they fly drones to be the police. This is a set of drones that are to police other drones in the sky. So specifically, it's for drone interdiction. And there's a picture of it, and we're going to link it, and it's beautiful. They are going to have 10-foot drones. And these are like multi-rotor copters. 10 feet is really big, but it's they have a drone, an anti-drone drone, essentially. And it... one of the things that it deploys to catch other drones is it has a big net that it trails underneath it. And so I guess the implication is that the operator of this drone would fly it over the offending drone that's in the no-fly zone and like kind of tie it, catch it up in the net and then bring it down to the ground. I know a while ago, a few episodes ago, we talked about that, that anti-drone gun that essentially shoots.
Oh, this is way better.
Yeah, that one was the one that you would kind of line it up and then pull the trigger, and it would send it would essentially just jam signals to the drone, and it would render it inoperable, and it would fall mostly straight down in theory. I think drone air combat is 100% more likely going to happen. So Tokyo is leading the way. They're going to be ahead of us for air combat. We're going to have to, you know, step it up a little bit.
I'm usually not on the side of the police getting technology that's really cool, because it usually is not used for good. But in this case, I'm totally in favor of it.
The picture of this thing is amazing. If it is really, it can't be 10 feet. That's huge. That I've never even seen a
mega drone.
Yeah. I almost want to get a drone to watch it get destroyed by this thing, because that would just be amazing. Yeah. And so the folks that they have that are piloting those drones, that's got to be a fun training program, right? You get to, you know, take other drones down just all the time. It's
anti drones.
Yeah
decoy drones,
right. You're gonna have to the drones arms race is the next thing. It's coming out. I mean, whether you arm the drones or not, which is not a thing, by the way. I feel like we've talked about that too, trying to put firearms on drones. I feel like it's inevitable. It's really a bad idea, just like maybe the worst idea, but but drone air combat I think is is a thing I can get behind.
It's a thing. We finally got a thing. I think this is the most not a thing heavy, not a thing episode yet.
Well, something else that is a thing is Star Wars. It's coming, but also coming this season is Christmas and the eventual proliferation of Yule log videos at holiday parties and things like that. And I found a while ago there are a number of Yule log videos that are around on the internet. So there's the original kind of one from 1966. So it's Yule log videos, for those that have never heard of them, are just videos of fireplaces, and it's a fireplace that's burning, and they'll play usually kind of Christmas music kind of associated with it, and it's just a nice thing to have on in the background of a party, or
if you can't afford an actual fireplace,
right? Or if you live like I do and don't have a fireplace, it's kind of nice. But because that was from 1966, you obviously have to update it for high definition and things like that. And so there are multiples of these if you look around on the internet. And there are ones that aren't just fireplaces. There's one that I found a while ago that is Nick Offerman and the Yule log. And
yes,
it's just him in front of a fireplace sipping scotch for 45 minutes.
Well, that's got you covered for 45 minutes. You found another one that will cover you for 5 hours. So your whole evening will be saved. And it's the pyre of Darth Vader lighting it on fire. And then it's 5 hours of Darth Vader's corpse being burned.
Oh, my God. So I think this is a thing for multiple reasons, not the least of which is it's very timely from a both kind of Christmas season and Star Wars release point of view. But it's also probably the only thing you can watch on the internet that won't spoil you for the new movie. There's been so much just hype and marketing around the new Star Wars movie. I it's really overwhelming, and I'm glad I'm seeing it Friday, if only to keep me mostly spoiler free before I sit down and watch the movie. I did read not too long ago that there was a couple that bought some Star Wars figures at a Walmart and took pictures of them and put them online, and Disney put a cease and desist on their Facebook account because it was the figures had not been released yet, and they didn't know that. It was they were just at their local Walmart and they bought them. But I guess, however, the figures are maybe the accessories or maybe one of the things on the packaging, it spoils part of the movie. And I just think the hype machine around it and all of the kind of people who are like, you know, trying to protect spoilers and everything like that, it's just so it's frankly annoying. It's getting to the point where it's not diminishing the experience of the movie, but it is kind of reducing my excitement about it, because I have to be so just vigilant about not clicking on links and things. And so there's actually a Chrome plugin. Did you hear about this? It's called,
yes.
I think it's called Force Blocker or something to that effect, but it's a Chrome plugin that when it detects Star Wars stuff in a link or an article, when you click on that link, it will give you a like spoiler warning page before you click through to see the rest of it. And I think that's sad.
Once down the dark path of spoilers you go, Alan, forever will it dominate your destiny.
So I'll be watching the Sith Lord Yule log and maybe a despecialized edition or three before Friday. Hopefully there's enough time to do all of that. I'm sure there is.
I think the real question is, how many times are you going to see the movie between when it comes out and when we record again?
We'll see. I'm gonna guess two times, maybe even three.
I'm thinking two to three. That gives me, I mean, it's less than a week, but yeah, I think it's probably gonna be two to three times by the time, of course. So we'll be fully prepared, fully armed and operational, ready to discuss the movie.
Excellent. Well, Brendan, I bid you good luck in spoiler avoidance, and I will talk to you next week.
Till next time, Alan.